all for coming. Sorry, I just put myself. So as Clive just said, I'm going to be talking today about De Rerum Natura, which is the Latin epic poem written by the Roman poet Titus Lucretius Carus at some point in the 1st century BCE. Lucretius' poem was written during the brief and lucid intervals that he experienced after he was driven insane by a love potion before he eventually committed suicide at the age of 44. In fact, that's almost certainly untrue. This is the account of his life that dates from 4 centuries after his death and was written by St. Jerome. Jerome, of course, the church father who was most famous for translating the Bible into Latin, and his version, known as the Vulgate, became the standard version used by the Roman Catholic Church. Jerome's account of Lucretius had a similarly decisive impact on the poet's reputation. Lucretius was, for Jerome and for a great deal of Christian readership, a dangerous and potentially subversive figure, whose thought could more easily be neutralised if it were depicted as the ravings of a lovesick lunatic. Jerome's account was all the more influential because it was often all that learned readers had to go by. Lucretius' poem was largely unknown throughout the Middle Ages until a manuscript was discovered in the library of a German monastery in 1417 by the Florentine humanist Poggio Bracciolini. As this manuscript was copied and circulated and gradually translated, Lucretius' poem was reintroduced into European intellectual life. It had a decisive impact upon some of the greatest philosophers and poets in subsequent periods, from Machiavelli, Montaigne and Milton, to Voltaire, Thomas Gray and Tennyson. But Lucretius never lost the reputation that Jerome had helped to establish, and reading, translating and imitating his poem never became an entirely safe activity, and I'll go on to talk a bit about why this was. In the 17th century, probably the first, complete translation of the poem into English was made by Lucy Hutchinson, an extraordinary woman who was the wife of the Republican soldier, Colonel John Hutchinson, and she wrote original poetry and theology, as well as a biography of her husband. In the preface to her translation of Lucretius' poem, Hutchinson felt the need to distance herself from her magnificent labour, insisting that she is, quote, convinced of the sin of amusing myself with such vain philosophy, and that she has, quote, thrown all the contempt that is due upon my author, whom she deems a lunatic. So on the one hand, Hutchinson's pouring an amazing amount of thought and effort into translating this poem. On the other hand, she's dismissing it as this frivolous and slightly meaningless thing. And I don't think any writer from this period who had devoted their days and hours to translating Homer, Virgil, or Ovid, the other great epic poets of antiquity, would have felt the need to belittle their chosen text in such vociferous terms. So in the lecture, one of the things I want to do is talk about how Lucretius came to occupy such a uniquely divisive place in European intellectual life. I want to talk about what it is in the poem that made him both widely influential and compelling, and also dangerous and slightly dubious. And I'm going to go through some of the aspects of Lucretius' poem that I find most exciting and compelling, and that helped to provoke this polarised view. But even before I do that, although it's kind of way into what I want to say about the poem, I want to say a little bit about the reasons that I think Lucretius might have been included as a part of a series of lectures on great books. I was talking to Edward a bit about this before, because I think it's a great choice, and I was delighted to be asked a lecture on Lucretius, but in some ways it's not an obvious choice. I know there's been a lecture on Homer. You might expect, perhaps, a lecture on Virgil as the great Latin epic. And I don't think Lucretius fits quite as straightforwardly into the great books tradition, for some of the reasons I've just been explaining, because he was such a controversial figure in some ways. And what I want to say at the start is that, speaking very broadly for a second, you might think of there as being two reasons that you would include a book in a great book series, or two ways you might think about what it means to establish a tradition of great books. And one way of thinking about this would be to say that great works are works that manage to perfectly encapsulate the historical moment that they come from. And therefore, when we approach them, what we try and do is meticulously reconstruct that moment in order to better understand them. But one version of this position would say that the reason we need to do this is that those works are, in a sense, lost to us. They are great in their distance from us, in what they can tell us about a world that's vanished in some sense. And therefore, when we think about them, what we're ultimately trying to do is reconstruct something that's gone. And the other way of thinking about a great book series would be to say that great books are books that actually leap out of or supersede their historical moments. and that there might be something called a great books tradition that, that exists above or separate from the details of historical contingency. And these are the books that somehow manage to jump across historical distance and to speak to us directly. So I don't think anyone would quite argue explicitly for one of those extreme positions, but though you might think of those as the two extremes of ways you might think about a great books lecture. And I don't think either of them's wrong. I don't want to commit myself to one of them to the exclusion of the other. In fact, in my own reading of literature from the relatively distant past, what I find the most fascinating in the works that, and the works that draw me back again and again, I think, are the works which make you feel as you're reading them that you're constantly oscillating between those two positions. Sometimes they feel as if they're so distant that you could never understand the world and the mindset that they sprung from. And sometimes they seem so amazingly immediate and close to you that you can't believe it was written 500 years ago or 2,000 years ago in this case. And you feel as if it must have been written by somebody who had thoughts and feelings and ideas much like yours. And I think if we lose either one of those, then we lose a lot. And in fact, the works that I find the most interesting are the ones that, that you find yourself as you read them constantly oscillating between those possibilities. And that's, I think, what reading Lucretius does so wonderfully. That's what makes him really exciting. Now, that's a very general point, but it's also a specific thing about Lucretius, as I'm going to go on to say. I think his poem is in many ways about that process of nearness and distance. This is one of the things I think he's most interested in as we read, bringing us very, very close in and then suddenly casting us back from what he's saying and putting us in a very distant and alienated position. So I actually think the description of literary history I'm giving you, of the great tradition I'm giving you, is actually something we can also find within Lucretius's poem. And that might be another reason to include him on such a list. Now, I want to start, now I'll turn to the poem itself, having made that general claim, and I'll come back to it at the end. A quick point, I've on the handout I've put the quotations I'm going to be using in from the English prose translation that I think Edward mentioned would be referring to. This is the Penguin Latin translation. I've also included the Latin just for those who are interested. I won't until the very end of the lecture say anything about Lucretius's Latin. I want to deal with the ideas in the poem, and then at the end I'll come back and say something more specific about the fact that this is, after all, a poem, because I don't want that to get lost in the discussion. Now, the first thing I want to talk about in relation to Lucretius's poem is its title, De Rerum Natura, which translates something like On the Nature of Things, or Concerning the Nature of Things. And one of the interesting things about this, of course, if you compare it to other epics with which you might be more familiar from Greek and Latin antiquity, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, these are tales of, in the case of the Iliad, a particular place, Troy, Ilium, and in the case of the Odyssey and the Aeneid, the stories of particular individuals, heroes. Epics are things that have heroes, right? The Odyssey has Odysseus, the Aeneid has Aeneas, these are the men who give their names to the poems. And if you thought, as you sat down to read Lucretius, that you knew what an epic poem was, something like a long poem telling the story of an individual hero's battles and adventures, then you might be quite confused or confounded when you sat down to read it. It's a poem that seems to lack a hero, and its title proclaims much broader aims than the story of a particular place or a particular man. It's going to account for the nature of things. What an amazing claim to make in your title, right? It's going to give an account of reality in its totality and as it really and truly is. Now, as Clive said in his introduction, one of the exciting things about reading this poem, I think, is that for us, it seems to cut right across that very fundamental division between the arts and the sciences. So we might have a lot of reasons to sit down and read a poem, but I doubt one of them would be to find out the nature of things as they truly are. I don't think that's a motive that's going to draw us into the reading of poetry very often. For us, if you want to find out the nature of things, an epic poem is unlikely to be your first port of call. It'd be great if it was, but I think it's probably not unlikely. And there is, of course, long before Lucretius, a tradition of seeing poetry, this is from Plato most influentially, as basically lying. This is Plato's critique of poetry. In a nutshell, it's lies. If you say once upon a time there was a house and there wasn't a house, you are a liar. This is Plato's critique of poetry. So even in antiquity, I think to set out to claim that you will give a poetic account of the truth of things is quite a bold and exciting thing to do. But the account that he gives of creation is not his own original version. He's very open about this. He seeks to expound and to justify to a learned Roman audience the thought of the Greek philosopher Epicurus. Now, I'm going to go on to say later in the lecture that he isn't just dressing up someone else's thoughts in pleasing poetry, although he himself says he's doing that at some point. I don't think he is. He's not just trying to make it more palatable or more accessible to a Roman audience. But it's Epicurus' thought, nonetheless, that forms the basis of everything he writes, even as he draws out its implications in unique and idiosyncratic ways. And he starts the third book of the poem, this is number one of the handout, with a paean, an address to Epicurus, whom he addresses as, "You, who out of such blackness were first to lift up so shining a light, revealing the hidden blessings of life, you are my leader, O glory of the Grecian race." So although, as I said, this is a poem that lacks a hero, one possible candidate for the hero of the poem would be Epicurus. That would be one way of thinking about this. But what was it that made the thought of Epicurus, a Greek philosopher who lived more than 2 centuries before Lucretius and whose thought survived only in scattered fragments and in the writings of his followers? What made this so compelling to Lucretius and so worthy of presentation to a Roman audience? Now, partly, I think, and this might sound strange to those of you who have ventured into this poem, one of the things that makes it an attractive philosophy, I think, that Lucretius is putting across, is its alluring simplicity. This is undeniably a complex and difficult poem in many ways, but everything in it springs from a basic and very easy to explain set of tenets. So if we're going to turn a particular philosophy into poetry, this isn't a bad one to choose. As Lucretius articulates these most basic principles in his first book, this is number two on the handout. All nature, as it is in itself, consists of two things: bodies and the vacant space in which the bodies are situated and through which they move in different directions. That doesn't sound particularly controversial to us. Lucretius insists that these bodies can always be resolved or divided into minimal parts, which cannot then be further divided. And this is what he says. These, he says, are atoms. A very familiar word to us. Fascinating to find it already being talked about in this ancient philosophy. Material objects are of two kinds, he claims, number three, atoms and compounds of atoms. And this is the Epicurean position in a nutshell. All entities, without exception, are comprised of material and irreducible atoms which exist and move within an empty void. And both sides of this, I won't go into this too much in the lecture, but I can talk about it later, both sides of this are extremely controversial for all sorts of reasons. The notion that there is a particle that can't be divided any further is controversial, and the notion that there is such a thing as a void, you've probably all heard the saying, nature abhors a vacuum. There's a very old philosophical debate about this, whether there is such a thing as a vacuum, or whether for whatever reason, the universe has to be entirely full of matter. Epicurus insists that there is a vacuum, and that's what the atoms move within. But what I think is really exciting about the poem is you start with this basic tenet that all things are made of atoms moving in a void. And then Epicurus, and following him Lucretius, goes on to draw from this simple fact a comprehensive account not only of the material world and its operations, but of the human body, the human senses, the soul, human love and sexuality, natural phenomena, the structure of the universe, and the shape of human history. So again, going back to the kind of art-science divide, the other thing that I think is quite amazing about this is, I don't think, though this perhaps will be an interesting thing to discuss, I don't think we tend to assume that our ethical beliefs, our beliefs about the way we treat other people, or our attitude towards the world, relies upon our commitments about the fundamental nature of reality, if that makes sense. So I don't think we feel like we need a theory about what the world is made of if we're going to know how to treat other people in it, or how to understand, say, historical change, or the nature of human sexuality, or the other things that Lucretius is going on to explain. And that, I think, is a really interesting thing, that this poem is insisting that you start with this basic ontological claim, a claim about being, a claim about the nature of the world, about atoms in a void. And from that, you can extrapolate not just a set of physical claims, but a set of ethical and historical interpersonal claims, social claims. All this springs from this material philosophy. And that combination of things, I think, is one of the most fascinating things about the poem, one of the strangest parts of reading it, but one of the most extraordinary, I think. And one of the things I think Lucretius is doing in the poem is performing for the reader the interconnection. interconnectedness of all these things. So he's showing that once you accept a certain account of the material world, all these things spring from it. Now, one of the things Lucretius was doing in appropriating this this basic Epicurean position, and now we can hear, I'm going to say a bit more explicitly why later Christian thinkers like Jerome and many others found him so troubling. One of the things he was doing was insisting that because all entities and all processes involved only atoms swirling in a void, there's no divine agency in Lucretius' picture of the world. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean there are no gods, and to say this, to say there's no divine agency in Lucretius' picture of the world might come as a bit of a surprise if you yourself have read the opening of the poem, which is a prolonged and impassioned address to one of the most familiar of Roman deities. And this is not on the handout, I apologise, this is my slip. Mother of Aeneas and his race, delight of men and gods, life-giving Venus, it is your doing that under the wheeling constellations of the sky all nature teems with life, both the sea that buoys up our ships and the earth that yields our flood. You alone are the guiding power of the universe, and without you nothing emerges into the shining sunlit world to grow in joy and loveliness. So that sounds almost like the opposite. He's calling Venus the guiding power of the universe. But what happens, for those of you who've read the opening of the poem, will have seen this, what's really interesting about this famous dedication that was much imitated by later writers, is even by the end of it, even by the time you're about 50 lines or so into the poem, Lucretius has made clear that the version of the gods he's presenting is very different from the version that a pious Roman reader might expect. He insists that, and this is number four on the handout, it is essential to the very nature of the deity that it should enjoy immortal existence in utter tranquility, aloof and detached from our affairs. So actually, I'm going to start coming back a little bit here to the thing I was saying at the start about proximity and distance, about this kind of transformative movement that he wants his reader to undergo as they read the poem. As I've said, he on the one hand begins with giving you this very vivid picture of Venus, life-giving. It's your doing, he says, that it's through your doing that all of nature teems with life. And he goes from that, by 44 lines in, he's saying the nature of deity is aloof and detached from our affairs. He's giving you this god, vividly, as you might expect at the start of an epic poem, a divine invocation, and already he's started to pull it away before your eyes and tell you, actually, this god's going to be very different from the kind of god you thought existed. It's not going to be a god who's directly involved in mortal affairs, but a god who is aloof and detached and tranquil. So there are gods for Lucretius, actually. He's not, despite his later reputation, an atheist. Hutchinson, whom I mentioned before, she felt the need to insist in the dedication to her poem, this is number five, she said, I abhor atheisms and impieties in it, and translated it only out of youthful curiosity, without the least inclination to propagate any of the wicked, pernicious doctrines in it. So he very strongly is associated with atheism in later writing. But as far as the whole question of atheism is a complicated one, what it means historically, but for us, atheism means a disbelief in God, an absence of belief in God. Lucretius has divinities, but they are so distant, so removed from human affairs, so uninterested in human affairs, that their existence effectively becomes irrelevant. It's nugatory, it's a matter for speculation, but it doesn't make any difference to our lives. But as I've said, I think what's really interesting to me about this opening invocation is partly this movement. It's not just telling the reader from the outset the gods are distant and uninterested, and whether or not they exist doesn't really matter. He gives you the gods and then gradually draws them away before your eyes. And I do think this movement is really important. One of the genres that Lucretius' poem is often placed in is didactic poetry. And he certainly does have extremely grand pedagogic aims. I don't think he just wants to teach his readers new ideas, to tell them Epicurus' ideas about things. He wants to show them, to take them through the idea that matters that they had taken for granted are actually entirely different from how they seem, or work on an entirely different basis. So like Trump Fraser, this opening of the poem contains within it an attempt to transform the reader's understanding of what a god is, or the role that a god might play in a human life. And so I actually think his aims are very grand. I think he wants to leave the reader of his poem a different person than the one they were when they began reading. I actually think his aims are that grandly transformative. And I think part of the magnificence of the poem resides in these serious, perhaps hubristic ambitions, which begin with this tantalising withdrawal of Venus in the opening lines. By the fifth book, there are six books in the poem, by the fifth book he insists much more bluntly that, this is number six, you must not suppose that the holy dwelling places of the gods are anywhere within the limits of the world. For the flimsy nature of the gods, far removed from our senses, is scarcely visible even to the perception of the mind. So he's much more direct here in that he insists that the gods are absent. And in the sixth book, he goes on to explain the origins of superstitious views about the gods' wrath and their everyday involvement in human affairs. So I think the point is, by these later stages in the poem, the reader is ready for the direct lessons that have been hinted at in the poem's opening line. So this is one way we might start to think about the difference between, say, a philosophical treatise by Epicurus and an epic poem by Lucretius. I think this notion of the process the reader undergoes as they work through it is really important. Right. So, we have a godless world of atoms careening chaotically through a void, a world that's senseless and lacking in intrinsic direction or order. It's a world from which the gods are so fully absent that they might as well not exist. This is one version, I think, of the vision that Lucretius presents us with in the poem. And Jerome's account of Lucretius' suicide, brought on by raging love, although he says it's about love, that the connection of suicide with Epicureanism, I don't think is an accidental one. So there's this very interesting thing that happens when Epicurean thought is discussed in later periods. On the one hand, it's seen as a philosophy that leads to despair. And you can see how, in the little summary I just gave of it, if you really believe that things are quite as dark and senseless as atoms crashing meaninglessly into one another in a void, you can see how this might lead to despair at the empty meaninglessness of the world. But then the other thing Epicureanism becomes very closely connected with, and it's actually the other side of the coin in a way, is a commitment to debauched pleasure, which might seem like perhaps a reasonable response to a world so fully lacking in direction, if that's really all there is. Then why not yourself behave like a chaotic atom crashing around in a void, and perhaps trying to crash into as many other atoms as possible? And there are certainly parts of the poem that fit in with this very grim version of the atomistic hypothesis. Near the start of book two, we're given the rather bleak aphorism, all life is a struggle in the dark. But for the rest of the lecture, I want to show how I think Lucretius avoids this bleakness, or rather, and this is again going back to this back and forth movement I'm talking about, he oscillates in the poem between this kind of rather over-the-top pessimism and a much richer exploration of the varieties of human pleasure and delight. And finally, when I conclude, just to give you a sense of where I'm going, I want to suggest that his poem doesn't only describe these human experiences or these human pleasures, but actually has a very interesting way of thinking of itself as a source of these pleasures. So I will come back quite strongly in the conclusion to the way that Lucretius grants his poem, as a poet, a unique role in explaining the worldview, the Epicurean worldview that he seeks to justify and explain. If Lucretius places the gods at such a great remove from the details of human affairs, he often seems to insist that a wise Epicurean human should assume an equally removed and impassive stance, what he calls in book four an air of detachment and remoteness. The most famous articulation of this stance in the poem comes at the opening of book two, and this is, I think, number seven on the handout. What joy it is, he says, when out at sea the storm winds are lashing the waters, to gaze from the shore at the heavy stress some other man is enduring. Not that anyone's afflictions are in themselves a source of delight, but to realise from what trouble you yourself are free is joy indeed. What joy again to watch opposing hosts marshalled on the field of battle when you have yourself no part in their peril. But this is the greatest joy of all, to possess a quiet sanctuary stoutly fortified by the teaching of the wise, and to gaze down from that elevation on others wandering aimlessly in search of a way of life, pitting their wits one against another, disputing for precedence, struggling night and day with unstinted effort to scale the pinnacles of wealth and power. Doesn't sound very nice, really, does it? One of the things that I think is uncomfortable about these lines for a modern readership is that they make Epicurean ethics seem like a resoundingly elitist form of life, a form of life that is founded on Schadenfreude, that your own joy in your quiet sanctuary is actually augmented by watching the aimless wandering of those still in search of a way of life, is, I think, quite a grim outlook. This is not necessarily being presented as something, at least in these times, as something that is a universal goal for mankind. It is assumed that those who achieve this Epicurean repose and distance from the world will be a special few who are able to listen to the voice of the poem. And I do think one of them he's doing here, to talk slightly more about the poem in its context, is playing to the elitist proclivities of his Roman readership, and not least his patron Gaius Memmius, to whom the poem is dedicated. But again, as I read the poem, I see this as just one side of what he's doing. I think he's, on the one hand, committed to this vision of Epicurean ethics as an elite removal above the aimless mass of people. But there's another side of his imagination that I think is constantly concerned with the fears that guide and that warp all of human life, without exception. He writes in book 3 of, this is number 8 on the handout, that fear which blasts the life of man from its very foundations, sullying everything with the blackness of death and leaving no pleasure pure or unalloyed. And the thing that I think is potentially a guiding force for everybody in Lucretius' view is the fear of death. This is an interesting, again, I think in some ways familiar to us, but in some ways perhaps too familiar idea, that the fear of death is the principal evil in human life, and that overcoming it is the main aim of his philosophy. And this, of course, isn't unique to him. I think I was just last week in the Death exhibition at the Wellcome Trust in London. I don't know if any of you have seen this. It's quite an interesting rumination on the role of the fear of death and the idea of a good death played in the history of human life. Lucretius puts absolutely front and centre, and he fulminates against comforting accounts of the afterlife and insists that the soul dies with the body and that its atoms, the soul's atoms, are dispersed back into the endless dance of matter that comprises all things. Number 9, you must admit that when the body has perished, there is an end also to the spirit ripped to shreds throughout the body. It's surely crazy to couple a mortal object with an eternal and suppose they can work in harmony and mutually interact. Now again, you can see why this might worry a later Christian reader who has, one way or another, to find a way of conceiving of the human as the conjunction of a mortal object and an eternal object, the soul and the body. Of course, going back to Epicurus' first principles, if there is going to be such a thing as a soul for Lucretius, it has to be made of atoms. It has to be just as material as the body, but nonetheless different. There is no space in his worldview for any other understanding of a thing other than a thing made of atoms. And to be extremely sweeping for a second, you could understand the entire history of Christian thought about the soul as an attempt to not quite make the soul into a thing. So it's a way of understanding it as an entity, as an existing thing of some sort, but not a thing in the way that the body is a thing. And I think this is something that later Christian thinkers are often dancing around one way or another. Lucretius just denies it. If it's going to be such a thing as the soul, it's going to be a thing in an emphatic sense. It's going to be ripped apart when the body is ripped apart, and its atoms are going to flow back out into the constant flow of atoms that make up the world. But he doesn't think that this should produce a fear of mortality, but an indifference to it. So again, you can perhaps understand how saying to someone, don't worry about death, all that will happen is your soul will be ripped apart into a million atoms and sent back out into the world. That might not seem like the most comforting way to explain death to somebody, but he insists that this is, in a sense, the kind of sublime mundanity or ordinariness of death. It just, you know, you can begin to cook this up into sort of quite familiar New Agey versions of death when you go back into nature and those sorts of things. Death becomes simply one more instance of the processes governing all things, and it's therefore unworthy of the fear that warps our lives and that contaminates our pleasures. Now, what I find interesting, as I said, there are lots of versions. You can find versions of this, of course, in Stoic ethics and other places where the idea that we should have attitudes of indifference towards our own death, and so on. What's really interesting, if you go back to those lines that I just read, is that for him, the fear of death leaves no pleasure pure or unalloyed. So for Lucretius, if we want to have pleasure, if we want to be capable of pleasure, we have to find a way of putting the reality of our own death at a distance, of not caring about it. And I think that what you find in the poem is this alternation between the insistence that we should assume a distant and disinterested stance towards the world. That's, so as I've said, this is the kind of repose, the stepping back from things, the stepping up to another level, looking down on the kind of lost wanderers below you. On the one hand, he wants you to do that. But on the other hand, he has a commitment to understanding the detailed, atomistic basis of all our pleasurable experiences. So on the one hand, he's got this impulse towards stepping back and not caring, just letting things pass you by, in a sense. And on the other hand, he can't resist zooming back in and trying in detailed ways to understand the things we enjoy and the sensations that we seek. As I've said, it's all atoms, right? The same atomistic processes underlie the workings of the universe and the workings of the human body. If you want to really understand things, you have to really then you have to understand everything. All these processes are going on underneath the largest diversity of phenomena you can name. They are all understandable in terms of the atoms moving in the void. And for me, it's Lucretius' determination to enter into the details of human experience in order to transfigure them, in order to get us to understand them in new ways, that provides the poem as such an enduringly energetic force. And I want to just say something now about number 10 on the handout, which is I included in part because it's my favourite bit of the poem. But I think it captures this attitude, this habit of mind that I'm describing rather wonderfully. So as I've been saying, in Lucretius, if the notion of a soul is to have any meaning, it has to be made of atoms, and therefore it has to be mortal, it has to return into the universe when you die. But in book three, he sets out to explain, and I don't have this on the handout, which is a short quote, that neither body nor soul by itself, without the other's aid, possesses the power of sensation. So I'm partly just, as Clive mentioned, pushing it on my own interests here, but I'll explain why. It's by the interacting motions of the two that the flame of sentience is kindled in our flesh. So what he's saying is, for us to be the kind of things we are, body and soul have to work together. They're both made of atoms, they're still distinct, they work together, that's what enables us to experience the world. But I actually think he's confronting a problem that continues actually to vex modern philosophers of mind. If we understand our brains or our minds as truly material, then how are its actions to be distinguished from other things? How can the mind be totally rooted in the body but still differentiated from it? I think this is the kind of big philosophical question that Lucretius is trying to get at. His response, his rather ingenious response, is to insist that the atoms that comprise the mind or the soul are smaller than other atoms, and they're fewer in number throughout the body. So we don't have a body and a soul, as it were, perfectly layered over each other. We have a body, and then we have soul atoms sort of sprinkled through it rather lightly, and that's what enables us to experience it. But what I love about this argument, you can see how he needs this, right? Again, if he wants to have a notion of an atom-based soul that's distinct from the body, he needs to argue something like this. But what's wonderful about it for me is the evidence he marshals to argue for this claim, and this is what he said. For sometimes we do not feel dust clinging to the body, or chalk shaken on it, settling on our limbs, nor do we feel the impact of a mist by night, or a spider's gossamer thread when we are caught in their net, nor the flimsy vesture of the same creature falling upon our head, nor birds' feathers or flying thistledown, which are so exceeding light that they usually find it a heavy task to fall, nor the progress of every creeping thing, nor each of the footsteps that gnats and such like place upon our body. So true it is that many particles must be moved in us before the seeds of spirit mingled with our bodies throughout our frame begin to feel that the first beginnings have been struck. So what I think is fabulous about these lines is, again, he's just trying to argue for the same basic principles. The soul is atoms. It's a very abstract claim that he wants to make about the nature of the soul's existence vis-a-vis the body. But the evidence for these claims is drawn from this wonderful array of incidental and common experiences, or perhaps, what I really love about this passage is they are not quite experiences. Right? The things he's interested in are the things that we don't quite sense. or the things that are just at the very outskirts of us, in a sense. Things, you know, mists, dusts, the sort of creepy, crawly legs, things that we don't quite feel or might wonder if we really felt them or if it was just something else. Semi-sensations, you might call it. It's this wonderful notion that it's at those moments of the things that are at the very threshold of who we are that we have to look in great detail if we're to find evidence for this much more abstract set of arguments about the body and the soul and their relation to each other. So all things may be atoms in a void, but just as Lucretius's poem, as I said earlier, begins by presenting us with a familiar goddess and then removing her gradually beyond the sphere of human significance, in the same way, I think, in these lines, we're given this amazing array of everyday sensations, things that we can easily envisage or imagine, but we're asked to think of them in a completely new way and to imbue them with a new kind of meaning. We're suddenly seeing these things that we've probably barely bothered to think about before. We're suddenly seeing them as evidence for the nature of the human soul and its relationship with the body, and that, I think, is wonderful. The notion that we can find relevance for the largest human questions in the footsteps of gnats across our body, or a spider landing on our head, or the impact of mist by night. The idea that these things might tell us something profound about who we are is, I think, one of the most amazing contributions of the poem. And again, I think it's, for me, the opposite extreme from this sense of distance, rather elitist repose and disinterest in the world, is this intense fascination with its minute working. So, I want to end now by saying a few words, returning, as I said earlier, to the fact that what we're dealing with here, after all, is a poem and not a philosophical treatise. Because it's not incidental, but absolutely essential to Lucretius' undertaking. As you'll have seen, if you've read any of the poem, he deals very explicitly with the poetic texture of what he's doing. One of the comparisons, he's always comparing atoms to things. One of the points about atoms is you can't sense them directly, you can't experience them directly. You're always experiencing massive lumps of them, effectively, formed into things. You can't pinpoint an atom. So you always have to find things to compare them to. One of his most famous examples is dust motes in a sunbeam. So when you see a sunbeam coming through a window onto what you might have thought was empty air, you suddenly see that it's absolutely full of these particles of dust cavorting and playing with one another in this seemingly empty space. But the other one he comes back to again and again is a comparison of atoms to letters. This is number 11. Consider how in my verses, for instance, you see many letters common to many words, yet you must admit that different verses and words differ in substance and in audible sound. So much can be accomplished by letters through mere change of order, but the elements can bring more factors into play so as to create things in all their variety. Elements there means atoms, so this is elemental, one of his other... it's primordia, actually, in Latin, but he uses elementa as well for atoms. These are other terms he uses. So the idea is that just as atoms don't have qualities in themselves, that they can nonetheless come together into things that are larger than some of their parts, in a way. In the same way that letters can build up into words, the same set of letters can be combined in all these different ways and take on all these different kinds of meanings. So you can see how this is rather a neat and nifty way of getting people to think about the atoms that he's talking about. But you can also see that it has a really interesting implication for his poem. It means that he's not just telling you about this process. It means that his own poem, each time he writes a new word, in a sense, he's performing for you the way that he's telling you that reality is working. So the more that letters enter into more and more new combinations and form new words and sounds and new meanings, the more he's reminding you this is how atoms work. So the whole poem is actually performing the sort of dance of combining and recombining atoms that he's trying to argue for. So I don't think there's another poem I can think of for which its very existence in and through language is ceaselessly teaching you something, is reinforcing the message that it's trying to get across, just by meaning something on the page or as you listen to it. It's showing you the truth of what it's trying to argue for. But the other thing I want to just say briefly in ending is that this also affects the way he thinks about his poem in more detailed ways. I've said I won't say too much about the Latin, because I imagine some people will be more interested in that than others. But if you just cast your eye over any of it, really, you will, even if you don't have Latin, you'll probably notice how much Lucretius delights in the play of sounds. He loves wordplay, he loves puns. I can say a bit more about that if anyone's interested in puns. His are probably the most learned and philosophically serious puns in the history of punning, which doesn't have a very high reputation as a way of using language. But just go back to number one quickly. Give an example. E tenebris tantis tam clarum expolere lumen. You've got this, I mean, lots of poems alliterate, lots of poems which mean repeat the same syllable, tenebris tantis tam ex tollere, portuisti, the strands. You have this amazing density of alliteration. There's lots more going on here that I won't talk about now, but that's just one example. Lots and lots of poems alliterate, sure. But again, what's rather wonderful about this philosophical poem that he's given us is that these basic linguistic features take on a much more serious meaning. One of the things he does in the poem is give an account of the atomistic basis of sound, which is for him, again, a material process of atoms striking and scraping the ear. If you go back to the end of the handout, the last quotation, I think. All forms of sound and vocal utterance become audible when they have slipped into the ear and provoke sensation by the impact of their own bodies. Besides, the voice often scrapes the throat and a shout roughens the windpipe on its outward part. So even something like a sound, which you might think of as the least physically substantial thing, again, barely a thing, becomes, in his account, again, another movement of atoms. It's a scraping. It's this kind of thickened atomic phenomenon. So again, in the actual sound of the poem becomes another way of arguing for the atomistic basis of everything. Each time, in a sense, a word hits our ears, the more linguistic power you can give to his poetry, the more we feel like it's hitting us as we read it or as we hear it, the more of an argument he's making for the Epicurean world. So this is, for me, what makes this poem fascinating, is it has extremely broad, expansive aim. It really does want to change the way that we look at everything. But just as that's happening both in the description of the gods and in the description of things like mist and thistledown and all these other things, so also it's happening in terms of the big arguments that the poem makes, but it's also an argument being made by the way the poem sounds, by the actual physical impact of the words upon.